This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois State University political scientist Carrie Melita says voter security means different things to different parties.
Republicans are really concerned about voter fraud, right? Because people that are more likely to commit voter fraud tend to be registered Democrats.
And Melita says in Mary Cullen's report that Democrats are more worried about Russian hacking because President Trump won. Plus, a tale of a pyromaniac from a next-to-normal story slam, a new art exhibit at the University Galleries needs public input, and John Norton reports on a new bronze at a Central Illinois sculpture walk. All that and a GLT News update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Illinois election officials are still trying to determine how best to safeguard the election process and voter data. That's after Russians hacked the Illinois voter log in the 2016 election, exposing 76,000 voter registrations. GLT's Mary Cullen reports on election security at the county level and how it's sometimes difficult to see where election security stops and politics begins.
Some voter information is not under state control. County clerks and election commissions want to stop voters from registering in more than one place and voting, and they use private corporations to help vet their own data. Carrie Melita is an assistant professor of political science at Illinois State University. Melita says databases such as CrossCheck and ERIC compare voter rosters to catch duplicates.
If the same person with the same social security number, for instance, is quote-unquote registered to vote in multiple states, it pings that and alerts the election administration officials that something's going wrong.
The difference between CrossCheck and ERIC is important in a political sense. Melita says CrossCheck uses more factors, which often leads to pinging marginalized voters for address checks.
These are people that don't vote a lot. Maybe they only vote every other presidential election year. They tend to be lower socioeconomic status. They're more likely to be minority voters. And so what critics are saying is that CrossCheck basically is helping Republicans.
In other words, Melita says it purges voters who are more likely to vote democratically.
Republicans are really concerned about voter fraud, right? Because people that are more likely to commit voter fraud tend to be registered Democrats. Democrats are concerned about Russian election hacking because Donald Trump won the election.
ERIC, on the other hand, is much less controversial. It pings fewer voters. CrossCheck uses first name, last name, and birth date when searching for potential duplicate voters. ERIC only uses social security numbers. Matt Emmons is the IT director at the Illinois State Board of Elections. Emmons says the board has access to both systems, but Illinois raised questions about database security to CrossCheck last year. He says they have not heard back.
We're just sort of waiting to hear from them. We and a lot of other states said we want to see the security of this program before we continue sending any data to it, and they haven't even opened it back up to us to send them any data. So that's one of those things that I suppose if and when the time comes, we'll deal with it. But otherwise, we're just standing by.
Emmons says only ERIC is being used on the state level now. Last year, an analysis of CrossCheck from researchers at Harvard, Stanford, the University of Pennsylvania, and Microsoft found that for every one double registered voter, CrossCheck would ping about 200 legitimately registered voters for an address check. Michael says the county's office uses both CrossCheck and ERIC by law, but that county voter fraud is a non-issue.
Well, we've never had a problem in the 8 years that I've been working as county clerk. We've never had any reports of voter fraud, any hanky-panky going on out there.
Despite Michael's lack of concern on the county level, the State Board of Elections hack in 2016 brought action by lawmakers. Republican Governor Bruce Rauner vetoed a measure last month that would prevent Illinois from using CrossCheck. Remember, Democrats like ERIC instead. Michael's Democratic challenger for McLean County Clerk, Nikita Richards, says her reaction to the governor's veto was one of sheer disappointment.
I didn't quite understand it because in my mind, and as I read through this piece of legislation, it's common sense legislature that would really protect voter information. And to me, If you're not interested in protecting voter information, then my next question would be, why not?
Cross-check is free, and Eric costs money. Richard says even so, she wants to see Illinois stop using cross-check.
You get what you pay for with cross-check. Eric is by far much more efficient. You know, we don't have to worry about the false positives that we see with cross-check. If we are really focused on protecting voter information, then why not go with the best option, even if there is a minimum cost to that?
Richard says cross-check has been used as a weaponized tool to enforce voter suppression in communities of low income and communities of color.
We can't overlook that, right? It is the elephant in the room, and it is what needs to be talked about. Cross-check has been responsible for purging and removing people from the voter registration logs wrongfully. And so there are states that have denied people their basic civil rights, that right to vote, because of this false information.
Richards also says the county's aging voter machines make the whole system less secure. The clerk's office says county voting machines are 17 years old. Illinois will receive a $13 million grant to increase election security, but the money is planned to place the state's election authorities on a secure data network rather than address old voter machines. Michael says purchasing new equipment at the county level would cost taxpayers an estimated $500,000. And while machines are aging,
our vendor assured us that our equipment is fine. They have backup equipment. They were smart enough to buy old equipment and store it. So if anything breaks down, it can be easily replaced quickly.
Michael's main concern instead is the use of social media and its ability to disrupt the election process.
The concern is disrupting. The disruptors out there, fake news, if you want to call it that, just trying to scare voters from voting. So just our advice is don't let anybody scare you, because then they win. And we're always going to have somehow, somewhere, a place for you to vote.
The Republican Michael is referring to a call that the clerk's office received on Election Day in 2016, saying ISU had run out of paper ballots when it in fact had not. Michael thinks word about this mishap dissuaded residents from voting at ISU. Democrats say, in reality, there were not enough election judges at ISU to handle the influx of people, and hours-long wait times discouraged some voters. The county board later approved additional money to add election judges. Michael says her efforts will be to stop the deterrence of voters on social media by shutting down the county clerk Facebook page on Election Day. Richards, on the other hand, says why demonize social media, calling it an amazing tool for elections and getting the word out to vote. She says instead of shutting down the county clerk's Facebook page, there should be an effort to make the clerk's website more user-friendly. Political science expert Melita says social media is not a major concern for election security.
That's Mary Cullen reporting. In addition to their other efforts, the McLean County Clerk's Office is rolling out an updated cybersecurity system this year.
Support for GLT comes from Illinois State University. Illinois State provides accessible opportunity and increasingly reflects the nation's changing demographics, with a 10% increase in African-American students and a 9% increase in Latino-Latina students among this year's freshman class. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Coming up, a new exhibit at the University Galleries and a chance to have input into that art coming up tomorrow at the Bloomington Farmers Market. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Bloomington's Herb Eaton says his Mommy's Broom bronze sculpture, chosen for this year's Peoria Sculpture Walk, is actually a vision from 30 years ago. Eaton was one of 8 artists chosen from a pool of 114 entrants to have their sculpture featured along Washington Street in Peoria's Warehouse District through close to the end of October, October 27th. Eaton speaks with GLT's John Norton from the second floor of his downtown Bloomington gallery and studio. He says the original idea for the sculpture came to him in graduate school while thinking about hobby horses.
And how wonderful they are. And when I was a little boy, how I enjoyed playing and pretending. I lived out on the edge of the country and, you know, it was wonderful going in the woods. And then, of course, you lose all that. And so I came up with this idea. Wouldn't it be cool to make cast bronze heads so that somebody who lost their imagination can pay me good money to make the horse head for him? I did quite a few smaller ones. Well, the problem is, too, though, that boys are in an unusual condition now relative to the history of the world. And I think a lot of attention should be paid to try to see if something can be solved. And I don't have the answer to the solution to any of this stuff. But I do know that if people look at a static object, that's what sculpture is wonderful for, and look at it repeatedly, go back and compare what their thoughts on this idea are with maybe what the world is, maybe something can happen.
Well, let's explain the sculpture. It's a young boy, about 7 or 8 years old. He's dressed in nothing but a glorified loincloth or real small shorts.
Kind of a diaper.
Okay, it's called a diaper, okay. He's got a cornstalk in his right hand.
Yeah.
In his left hand, he's riding a broom.
Right.
And the business end of the broom is up top, and there's a horse head coming out of that.
Right. Okay. Bigger than an average horse.
And he's got a beanie on his head.
Right.
With a propeller.
Right.
And there's scrap metal on the bottom with a bomb.
With a bomb.
So it's a bronze stainless steel sculpture.
Right.
This harkens back to, you're a little bit older than me, but not that much, right? So back when we were young, and you see these memes on Facebook all the time about when we were young, how we ran wild, right?
Yeah.
We came home at lunch and dinner when mom called us, literally yelled out the front door. And if we heard her, we came home, and then we'd go back out. And this seems to harken back to a time like that when you rode hobby horses, when you know you had to use your imagination because you couldn't put your face in an electronic object.
Right.
And is that kind of what you're getting at?
Yeah, and the beanie? Do you remember the beanie? You remember Cecil and Beanie?
Yeah.
Mighty Mouse, Tom Terrific, all these different, the Jetsons, everybody had beanies. It's the idea of your imagination has to fly. And then when I made my horse, it's mommy's broom. It's literally made like a broom.
Yeah.
And he's riding it. And then the idea is that this horse head comes out of it, and it's like bigger than an average horse. And it's 125 pounds of bronze sticking out there. And it looks wild. And the idea is that boys have to have this imagination, and you have to try to, you know, control it. And he's obviously maybe not doing such a good job of controlling it, but that's the idea, the big overall metaphysical idea about this. And I also was early in Mad Magazine. I love Mad Magazine.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And Spy v. Spy, which seems to be like comes back, you know, like today in the news. And they always had these round bombs with these little fuses out. And I always just thought they were really cool, you know. And so he's standing on this round bomb with a fuse sticking out of it. And this pile of junk, which I literally got out of a scrapyard.
And we should say this bomb looks like something Wile E. Coyote would...
Yeah, right.
Right to chase down the road.
Yeah, you can buy it on at Acme.
But this is what it looks like.
Yeah.
It's on all this scrap metal.
And he's standing on it.
Okay.
Then my art historical background, it has this is an equestrian martial sculpture, which are being removed a lot of places because they seem to have a bad idea, which I tend to agree with. Historically, back in the Renaissance, technically they had problems casting horses to stand on 3 feet. They wanted it to look like they're marching, say, standing on 3 feet. And so they would put bombs under the hoof of the front, so they had 4 points of landing, and yet the horse's foot was up. And so I always loved those things because it kind of makes no sense when you look at it. You know that. So this kind of makes no sense.
All right. Herb Eaton is our guest on GLT Sound Ideas. You can see his sculpture in Peoria. It's part of the Sculpture Walk 2018
yeah.
along Washington Street in Peoria. 114 people wanted to be a part of this. Herb was one of 8 chosen. This is quite an honor. Authors, when they write fiction, they often say they don't know how their novel is going to end because the characters just kind of play out, right?
Yeah.
And you always have stories along with your
right.
art. Do you have a story that goes along with this in your own mind? Or are there, I imagine, many different stories? And did that story play out as you were creating the sculpture?
First of all, I created these characters about 30 years ago. I had this man and this woman, and then there was this boy who doesn't show up a lot. 30 years ago, and I would draw him and paint him and all this stuff, and then now I'm doing this skeleton on my blog. But they're characters. And the beauty of a character for any creative person is that if you give in to them, they decide what's going to happen. And this piece, the original maquette, was not going to look like this. It looked completely different. And I got mad at it. So the little boy and the horse head stuck separately in the studio for almost a year, just moved around. And all of a sudden, one day, they laid next to each other. And it was like, oh, the boy's got to be riding the horse, of course.
Okay.
He was supposed to be doing something else, and I forgot what it is. And then one thing led to another. Then that then became something that I could focus on. But yeah, you don't know where your characters are going. And I write a lot that goes along with it. And this guy, I might as well be truthful. The simple matter of fact is this is me harking back to the day when I was 8. 7, 10.
And we were all idealistic back then, right?
Yes, and we all had imagination and adventure. In fact, is when it came to making this particular boy's face and head, I had to use something. And what I did was go back into my old photographs and dug out my first communion pictures when I was about 8 years old or something. And there were plenty of different shots of me from different sides, so I could kind of create that.
Interesting. All right. You're listening to GLT Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton with Herb Eaton. We're on the second floor of his gallery in downtown Bloomington. And we're talking about a sculpture. It's a bronze stainless steel sculpture. He calls it Mama's Broom. And you can see a picture of it on WGLT.org. So we talked a lot about the broom.
Uh-huh.
And the horse head, and even the bomb, haven't addressed the cornstalk in his right hand yet. It towers over him. It's almost twice as tall as he is. What's the representation there?
Well, when we were boys, and I think this is past
the... play in the woods. Were you talking about playing in the cornfields?
Yeah, we had cornfields across from my house until I was out of high school. And when we were kids, we would go in, and we needed spears so that we could be headhunters and cannibals and stuff like that. You know, the guy's dead. He's not going to call the police, but we would steal a cornstalk or two and then throw it at each other, you know? And then you could carry them along as banners, you know, kind of like the old Knights of the Round Table. And so that's basically what I did. I made the Knight of the Round Table guy with it. And I got incredibly fortunate and found this piece of scrap stainless that looked like a corn, with a little addition, looked like an ear of corn. The other part of this is I'm really fascinated by non-Western art, especially the people from New Guinea. I go to every time I get a chance to see something because they were such wonderful inventors. Now, you know, literally they were cannibals. I mean, supposedly they ate Michael Rockefeller. But I always respected their skills with making things. So that kind of is how that thing came about.
Well, you must be pretty proud of yourself. This is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. I don't know. Yeah, proud of yourself makes your ego get a little big, but I am really happy that I got to do it.
How long did it take you to actually put the whole this one together?
It became my life for about 9 months. You know, and I was going over to Peoria all the time to do things at Bradley, and then I've got my own studio here where I could do quite a bit of the thing. And then there were changes throughout it. Even at the end, we almost I mounted it once, then we took it down and cut it up and re-welded it in a slightly different configuration. Yeah, when you're doing a one-off anything like sculpture, and you got to move this all around, you got to move it in parts, and then you think it's all going to work out, and then all of a sudden it doesn't work out, then you get your plasma cutter out, you get your grinders out, and you cut the thing apart and you put it back together, which requires welding. And finally, I'm really, really happy with it now. I was happy with it several times along the path, but I was really happy now, especially being sitting over there and I'm able to sit here and plan whatever else I'm going to do in life.
Bloomington artist Herb Eaton speaking with GLT's John Norton. Eaton's bronze sculpture Mommy's Broom and sculptures from 7 other artists from 3 other states can be seen along Washington Street in Peoria's Warehouse District through October 27th. You can see Eaton's sculpture right now at WGLT.org.
Support for GLT comes from Westminster Village, providing quality retirement living options in Bloomington Normal for more than 35 years. Independent living apartments and duplexes, licensed assisted living, and skilled nursing care available. Information at westminstervillageinc.com. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Sometimes when that little angel on your shoulder is sitting there telling you, you really ought to think about that before you do it, and you don't listen to that angel, it turns into a great story. That's coming up in just a moment on 89.1 and WGLT.org. Places have their own geometries, and those lines and angles shape and are shaped by the people in them. That's part of the framework artist William Cordova explores in his exhibit Contour, Sacred Geometries, opening next week at the Illinois State University Galleries. Kendra Pates curates the exhibit, and Cordova himself joins us as well to talk about why he's seeking public input and collaboration tomorrow at the Farmers Market in Bloomington for a piece of art in the exhibit, a concrete sculpture.
We're looking for ephemera, hair follicles, small flowers, plants, bedroom residue that children might have left behind and gone off to college, small samples of dirt from somebody's front yard or backyard, things that represent the family, the individuals in that family, or person.
Constructed articles or personal and natural? What?
Both personal and natural, indeed. And for people to just bring them to our workshop, and we would incorporate them into the mix of this concrete sculpture that we're creating. And the sculpture is visually looks like a small transistor radio. And we're going to create this transceiver, if you will, conceptually, with the contributions that locals make to the piece. It's a age-old habit for a lot of people, different places, different countries, to incorporate their shoe or a shoelace, maybe some article from their clothing, after they finish constructing a building, especially in concrete is involved. So they put it into the mix. And last year when I had a residency at Illinois State University, I was talking to one of the employees in the art program who shared a story about her father actually being a construction worker who helped build an art department building. And he inserted also some items into that mix.
Why a small transistor radio as a metaphor? Well, unpack that for us.
I think besides the small transistor radio, up to this point in the early millennium, maybe the Volkswagen Beetle would be the only other object you could find throughout the world that it's being used by different people in different places, and transistor radios also. Hurricane comes, you're not going to see people with current technology too much. You rely on the transistor radio.
So as a cultural icon, it is crossing generations and it remains relevant to today. But how about the idea of transmission of these objects to the future, to a different public? What's the image you're going for?
Bridging differences and grounding ourselves physically and also symbolically in a concrete manner with the representation of a radio, something that we can also share with the public after it's completed. So it will be permanently at Illinois State University, that piece.
Kendra Pates, where can people do this?
We will be in the Kids Zone at the Bloomington Farmers Market starting at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. So that's at the northwest corner of the Museum Square. And it's National Farmers Market Week. So one of the things that we've told people is that they could also bring coffee, tea, different things that connect food to place as well. And then the exhibition opens to the public on August 16th, so the sculpture will be on display in the exhibition for the following 2 months. And William will also be working with ISU students when he returns in September to make another one that will be added in.
What commended this sort of project to the University Galleries?
Well, William visited here, as he said, he was an artist in residence in spring of 2017 through the School of Arts Visiting Artist Program. So he spent 4 weeks on campus working with our students. A lot of us got to know him. I was familiar with his work before and was really excited about him coming. And after he gave each of those artists gives sort of an initial introductory lecture when they begin their visit. And we started talking after the lecture. We had this really wonderful 3-hour lunch where we were sharing ideas and started talking about doing a project together. One of William's close friends, Terry Adkins, a late artist who actually is one of our very distinguished alums from the School of Art, we started talking about ways that Terry's legacy and his history could be incorporated. So the project has really grown over the course of the last year and a half.
What makes William's work really speak to you personally?
Well, I think there are, I'll talk for an hour about this. I think the ways that he talked about bridging, but the ways that he's trying to bridge different cultures, different ideas, different histories, philosophies, through materials, through unexpected presentations of those materials, through sincere interactions with the community. Wherever he travels for these different projects, he really does embed himself within a community, really gets to know people, gets to learn the history of the place. He's not somebody who sort of zips in, says, here I am, and hangs up a work and says, oh, could you participate in my project for this very commercial purpose, and then leaves again. So this started through conversations while he was here. There are a lot of references to our community built into the works that will be on view as well. Drawings that he made in coffee while he was here that reference the architecture of the community, or conversations he had, objects he saw on the ground on his walks. Some are works that he completed while he was here, these juxtapositions of Polaroids. So we're really, really excited about not just bringing an artist in, or not just having work on the wall or the floor, but thinking about all of the different ways that people can interact with the artist, with the work, with the ideas.
William, the name of the exhibit is Contour, Sacred Geometries. What does that mean?
It means condor, sacred bird, Andean sacred bird.
So. And how does that reflect on geometries and place and the kinds of things that Kendra just referenced?
Well, the contour is also a constellation, an Andean constellation that can be interpreted and has been incorporated in different constellations throughout the world and mythologies. So there's shared mythologies. The geometric factors are always incorporated into that.
And how did the geometries of Bloomington Normal create a mythology or a sense of shared being?
I could answer it in a more broad manner, but directly it would be through my walks from my where I was staying at the Waterston Tower to the art department or to university galleries or to other places throughout Normal. And I would document with my Polaroid camera or take mental notes and basically creating a map of my stay here for my 30 days and also through conversations. So I started making my own version of my constellations of Normal and the individuals that I met. And so that's incorporated into the exhibit through a suite of Polaroids, through coffee drawings, and other smaller ephemera. I think anybody who has the ability to look up and see the sky at night and make out certain constellations can always relate to somebody else on the other side of the world that might see the same one. I think those are the ways that I'm interested in bridging human beings.
Yeah. As part of what Kendra alluded to in the homage to Terry Adkins, you've done a film. Why a film as opposed to a different piece of art or a different medium?
I come from a film background somewhat at the Art Institute of Chicago, and documentary filmmaking is something that I was gravitated to. 60mm documentary filmmaking. And traditionally all documentaries were made with 60mm, not 35, not Super 8. Eventually video, sure, digital. But I come from analog generation. And I also think it's important to archive our presence, our human experience through analog, because it's probably the only thing that a sun flare cannot erase. Library of Congress does not take anything digitally. So even if it's made digitally. All that added to the fact that I wanted to make a portrait, a representation of Terry's presence here at a specific time, 1977, which is also the year I came to the U.S. And I don't think it's a coincidence, but eventually when we met, he became my mentor and eventually friend for many, many years. And
he died in 2014. Yes. How did his friendship and mentorship come out in this film? What?
I think it comes out in abstract forms. The framing of the objects in the film, the sound, the influence of the sound, the music, the collaboration that we did with our fellow artist and also student of and co-worker with Terry Atkins was Louis Gispert, who did the audio for the piece. Louis and I came up together at junior college. So this is a strong bond between the three of us, and also Edra Soto, who was also a friend of mine, who is a friend of mine, collaborated with us as well doing the documenting of the this environment, this space. So this is metaphysical interpretation of Terry's presence through by capturing the essence of a space, an apartment, a room, and the electricity, the energy of that space.
Kendra, let's get your perspective, your take on how the film reflects Terry Atkins.
Well, I think, so I curated an exhibition of Terry's videos a few years ago and made a book about him. So Terry's been on my mind and somebody I've been thinking about, sort of carrying with me. Also thinking a lot about his legacy and the people who are functioning sort of as stewards of that legacy. When William and I first started talking about the exhibition and doing a project together, we were sitting in what was then Anand, the Indian restaurant uptown, and we started talking about, oh, wouldn't it be great to incorporate Terry in some way? Fast forward a little way, and William said, what if we found the place that he lived while he was a student here in the 1970s? We had some of his works in University Gallery's permanent collection. William thought it would be a great idea to hang one of those works in the place where he lived at the time that he had made them. Through a lot of research and sort of serendipity because of other interactions with people while researching Terry, we actually found where he lived, and it turned out to be in the same building as the restaurant where we had had the initial conversation. So it was sort of this lovely kind of nod from the universe, from Terry, know, that, oh, this has to happen, and we don't know exactly how it will unfold yet. A few different ideas transpired, but in the end, I think what William and Idra and Luis have created really does speak to Terry's, to his presence, to his influence. It's not a documentary. It's not something that says Terry Atkins was born in this city. He mentored this generation of wildly influential artists. It speaks more to the way that Terry's presence lingers, too. I have some other moments with Terry that also felt like that, like he is lingering, like he is very much alive and present, even for... I only had the opportunity to meet with Terry once. He passed very suddenly, so I don't have the long personal relationship with Terry that William and Luis do, but I still feel very connected to him, and it's exciting for me to think about presenting this work here in this place that Terry lived, and continuing to keep his presence here alive as well.
The exhibition is William Cordova, Contour, Sacred Geometries. It runs from August 16th through October 14th at the University Galleries. William, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Kendra Pates, the curator of the exhibit. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Through August and September, Cordova will take part in a series of events open to the public. Thursday, September 6th, there will be a panel discussion with artists at University Galleries. Friday, September the 7th, the galleries will host a public reception about Kuntur. Saturday, the 22nd of September, there will be an exhibition, tour, and workshop conducted with the Children's Discovery Museum. And there's grant money available for field trip transportation costs. You can see pictures of some works in the exhibit at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Sometimes our mistakes make the best stories. That comes out in this one by Reese Lovell, as told at the McLean County Arts Center during the July Next to Normal Story Slam, produced by Devin Lovell. The theme for the evening was re, as in again or return to, or any number of re words. Reese Lovell recounts a couple times he should have or did rethink something.
There were a number of books and novels that were required reading during my junior high school years. Among those, we had The Pearl by John Steinbeck, The Martian Chronicles, Ray Bradbury. I was also a huge fan of another short story of his called There Will Come Soft Rains. Of course, you had Ernest Hemingway's The Old Man and the Sea, but the novel that made the biggest impression on me was a novel called The Pigman by Paul Zindel. For those of you who are not familiar with this story, I'll just set it up really quickly. The main two characters are two high school students, John and Lorraine, who are misfits, come from troubled homes, but they bond together, and they're always getting in trouble. And one of the things that Lorraine is fond of doing is prank calling people. And one night they prank call Mr. Pignotti, who they come to know as the Pigman. The setup is that they're looking for charity, people to give donations to charity, and Mr. Pignotti says, I'll give you $10. And they actually go to his house and accept the $10 check, but in doing so, they get to know him. And the three become great friends. So that's the setup of the Pigman. But the novel starts out as we're introduced to the character of John, who of course I identified with. He's known amongst his friends as the bathroom bomber because he's also a prankster, and he creates these using a lump of clay, a firecracker, and a birthday candle. He puts the birthday candle, you know, in the lump of clay, the firecracker next to it, wraps the fuse about halfway down the candle, puts it in the boys' bathroom at the high school, and you've got yourself an instant time bomb. And Zindel describes where he did this so many times that it got to the point where he would forget he'd set them, and he'd be in the middle of a class, and 10 minutes later, there's this huge bang that would startle even him. So as a reader of this novel, I was fascinated by this idea of building a little time bomb. And I thought, I'm going to try this. I think I can pull this off. So I got myself some clay, I got my firecracker, I got the birthday candle, and this is when I was going to Parkside Junior High School here in town. Thankfully, Mrs. Kirk wasn't my teacher yet, so I didn't have to worry about that. That would come later. And so on this particular day, I had my bomb-making materials ready to go, stashed in my backpack. I went to school, and I had decided that I was going to set this bomb in the bathroom, just like the character John did in the story, during the lunch hour. And of course, you know, there all these cliques of students, and I had a table that I sat at with my buddies, and they were the only ones who knew about it. Of course, I had to share that I was going to do that. I couldn't, you know, be an anonymous bomber. Somebody had to know who was behind this. So I had told them about this, and about halfway through the lunch hour, I had my backpack with me. You know, I winked at them and headed off to the bathroom. Got out my clay. I went to the last stall. I felt like I was trapped in a spy novel, a John le Carré or something like that. I was so excited and in the moment. I didn't know who John le Carré was then. I just threw that out. So I'm in the last stall. I put my lump of clay down. I put the firecracker in it and the birthday candle, wrapped it around very carefully, and lit it. Went back out. Sat down in the cafeteria, is all a buzz, and the teachers are walking up and down the rows like Gestapo, you know, checking, make sure that the kids are all in their places and no one's misbehaving. God forbid anyone should misbehave or set a bomb in the bathroom. And I sat back down at the table, and within moments, I realized that in the couple of minutes that I had been in the bathroom, word had gotten around the entire cafeteria that I had planted this bomb. You know, I'm looking across the way and there are these little hushed conversations going on between kids and snickering. And I thought, my God, what have I done? And so in that moment, I thought to myself, I need to rethink this. Unfortunately, I was caught in that moment. You know how when you're the phone rings in your house, the old landlines, you know, from yesteryear, and you're on the other side of the house, and you try to make that decision: do I go for it, or just let the machine pick it up? And invariably, at the last possible second, you dash, you know, from upstairs to downstairs or downstairs to upstairs, and you get there, and just as you pick it up, you hear the dial tone. And you know that the caller hung up seconds before. That's how I felt in this moment. I thought, as sure as I get up and make my way to the bathroom, about the time my hand hits the door handle, it's going to go off. So I was sweating, I was nervous, everyone's looking at me, all the kids are looking at me. The teachers, meanwhile, are unaware that any of this has happened. So I decided to go. I very quickly made my way to the bathroom, to the last stall, and managed to put it out. Breathed a huge, huge sigh of relief, you know, gathered up my bomb-making materials, walked back to the table, shaking. I was so nervous because, you know, the consequences of this would have meant, you know, I probably would have been suspended. A little bit of foreshadowing there for part two of the story. So when I sat back down, I looked around, and there was this look of disappointment on everyone's faces, like, you wuss. You know, this was going to be the coolest thing ever. You would have become legendary, and you wimped out at the last second. But as a result of that, I earned the nickname Pyro. Yeah. You would think I would have learned from that, or at least passed through that phase in my life. I did not. So, at Parkside, at the beginning of the year, there was this great custodian. His name was Larry, an ancient fellow, stood about 5 feet tall, pretty wide, and he had an assistant who looked like a character from The Far Side. Her name was Ruby, and she had this beehive hairdo. And standing next to him, you know, he's like this tall, and she's this tall. So at the beginning of the school year, before this bomb thing happened, Larry came around to the study hall that I was in and said, I'm looking for two volunteers to assist me with putting up the cafeteria tables when lunch is over and sweeping the hallways. And that will be your study hall. And I thought, great, yeah, this sounds like a blast. So my hand went up, and this other kid named Doug, his hand went up, and instantly we became Larry's part-time janitors. And that was the greatest feeling, because we didn't have to do that much. You know, it was, we'd put the tables up, they folded up like that, you know, and moved over against the wall. We would grab the two big dust mops, go up and down the hallway, and then we were done. And we would have that done in the first 10 minutes. So the rest of the time, it was like free reign. We could walk around the school with no pass because we were janitors. We would walk by classrooms, point at somebody, you know, in there looking bored. I'm free. Hey, freedom out here. You're stuck in there. And we could go into the kitchen. Larry said, help yourself to all the ice cream sandwiches you wanted. And so we would do that. And it was great. We were like a little family, Larry and Ruby and Doug and me. It was kind of like the Lohman family as drawn by Gary Larson from The Far Side. With me as Biff and Doug as Hap. So one thing that was in fashion then that ties right back into my pyromaniacal tendencies. You remember the Benaca breath spray things? You could turn those into a wicked flamethrower. If you had a lighter, you know, you lit the lighter, sprayed the Benaca breath spray, and whoosh, you know, you've got this jet of flame. It was the coolest thing ever. And so one day after Doug and I had finished with our duties, and we'd put up the tables and done our sweeping, we're in the janitor's closet, which is, you know, there's particulate floating through the air. It's just, if there was any area on the face of the earth that was combustible, it was the janitor's closet. And that was where I decided to show Doug how this flamethrower works. So, yeah. So Doug and I are standing in there. We just hung up our mops. The dust is coming down, settling on the floor. There's a slop sink in there. And I pulled out my Benaca breath spray. I said, Doug, this is the coolest thing. You got to check this out. Pulled out my lighter. I said, watch this. I lit the lighter, hit the Benaca breath spray. Whoosh! It hits the broom. The broom goes up in flames. Instantly, there's this inferno in the janitor's closet at Parkside Junior High. And Doug and I looked at one another like, what? What do we do? And I said, I don't know. It's a fire, man. I don't know. I'm just good at setting them. I'm not good at putting them out. So I grabbed the mop, still on fire, put it in the slop sink, turned on the water, and put out the fire. But there's all this, you know, smoke rolling out underneath the door. And the two of us are just standing in there shaking. Like, what now? But it was smoky and not safe. So we got out of there. As soon as we walk out, here's Principal Monahan, I think was his name. I can't remember. I'm looking to Peg for all of this. He was this short guy. Manahan, yeah. He's chugging around the corner. What's going on here? What's getting, you know, smoke is billowing out of the janitor's closet. And Doug and I swear to God, I looked at him and I said, Principal Manahan, this broom spontaneously combusted. I don't know. I don't have anything else. About that time, Larry came Larry came running up, you know, and he said, what's going on? And Principal Manahan says, he's claiming that this broom caught fire by itself. Larry says, boys, come over here. Tell him the truth. Tell him the truth, boys. So I revealed the truth, and as a consequence, as a punishment for our actions, we were both suspended, one day in school suspension. But I, damn if I didn't wear that as a badge of pride, you know. But for many years thereafter, or at least 2 years, that was my nickname. I was Pyro until the day when I became Hood Rider. But I'm going to save that story for the next Story Slam. Thank you so much.
Reese Lovell told his story at the McLean County Arts Center at a Next to Normal Story Slam, organized by Devin Lovell. GLT will occasionally bring these stories to you during Sound Ideas on 89.1 and WGLT.org. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Ryan Denham and John Norton. WGLT.org is the first place to go to subscribe for the Sound Ideas podcast. Also look at Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. We want to know what you think of Sound Ideas. Post comments at facebook.com/WGLTFM or tweet your comments. Use the hashtag Sound Ideas. We're all at WGLT News. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.